Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll hear about some police officers getting in trouble for what they say on social media. Just how far can cops go? Some advocates say those with drug addictions would be safer if the government allowed injection locations. Not everyone agrees. We'll hear some of that debate. The pandemic has impacted local health departments who had to put other priorities on hold this past year. We'll talk with one administrator. And COVID-19 has left more people food insecure.
One of the things that's really set apart the COVID time period is how many people are reporting in the last week, we have just not had enough to eat.
We examine hunger during the pandemic. We'll also talk with an author about the nation's reaction to Abraham Lincoln's assassination 156 years ago this month. Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide, and ahead, local health departments have had to pivot because of COVID-19. We'll hear from one administrator about what has changed in the past year. Should Illinois allow legal injection sites for drug users? And we'll look back at the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. It happened this month in 1865. Those stories and more on the way. People who fight hunger in Illinois say this has been a year unlike any they've seen. In many Black and Hispanic communities especially, there have been times when a quarter to a third of families with kids have reported not having enough food to put on the table. Odette Youssef from WBEZ has this report.
On an unseasonably warm but windy day recently, I met Alma Hernandez in the parking lot of a Dollar Tree store in Blue Island. I settled into the passenger seat of her minivan with the windows open. On the seat behind me were cardboard boxes filled with food.
I'm sorry for the stuff.
They're the previous day's haul from a food pantry Hernandez visits every Tuesday.
It's oatmeal, cookies, peanut butter, orange juice, apples, onions.
Hernandez's 5-year-old, Beatrice, creeps up to the microphone. She picks the peanut butter jar off the top of the pile and hides it under her shirt. It's her favorite.
Yeah, I received the food stamps, but this is really helpful. And I go to the food pantries all the time. When I see some place, I'm going.
This past year has brought deep despair to families across the country. For Hernandez, the hardship was compounded by a divorce. 2 months into Illinois' lockdown, she and her husband split. She says he was psychologically abusive, but he was also the breadwinner. It left her with 4 growing kids at home and no income. Normally, the kids would get breakfast and lunch for free at school, but since the pandemic began, they've been learning remotely.
Now, I need to cook breakfast, lunch, then another lunch, dinner, and snacks, but it's too much. It's too much expensive.
Before the pandemic, Hernandez says she never went to food pantries, but now she says she couldn't manage without them.
And don't miss. Los tamales hueso. Okay.
The food pantries have also helped Hernandez bring in some income. When she gets chicken, she makes tamales to sell. As we talk, a car pulls up next to us and rolls down its window. Customers picking up their order. She pulls tamales out of a couple coolers in the back seat and bags them.
Bye, thank you.
One of the things that's really set apart the COVID time period is how many people are reporting in the last week, we have just not had enough to eat.
Diane Whitmore-Schanzenbach is director of Northwestern University's Institute for Policy Research.
Those rates have been running over the course of the pandemic, an average of about 11% in Illinois, about 15% in Illinois for families with kids. That's something like a million people saying that they're hungry each week.
Whitmore-Schanzenbach has kept an eye on food hardship in Illinois for years. She says the rates of hunger and food insecurity roughly doubled during the pandemic. This despite an expansion of the safety net. A few weeks into Illinois' first lockdown, the state preemptively upped the amount of money in food stamps that nearly 500,000 Illinois households receive. And the number of Illinoisans getting food stamps between March last year and this past January was 17% higher than the same period a year before. The need has been highest among Black and Hispanic families.
It is the case that Blacks experience food insecurity at a little more than twice the rates of whites all the time. But you know, now when you look at it, you're like, you know, it's shocking.
Mary Galt has been helping these families. She's a family stabilization coordinator at Catholic Charities in Des Plaines. She says this past year, she's noticed something she'd never seen before. There's been an added layer of anxiety among her Latinx clients in asking for help.
Certain people who may not have complete documentation, that kind of thing, their fear of what asking for some kind of help will do to their chances of getting documentation.
This fear was particularly acute during President Trump's final year in office.
But once their kids get hungry, they call for help. And I've never seen that before. I've never seen it so blatant.
One of Galt's clients is Araceli Hernandez Escalante. Hernandez Escalante is the single mom of four kids. In September, her hours working overnight at a bread factory were cut. She started panicking one day when she realized all she could feed the kids were eggs.
The traumas.
For several weeks, her household was down to one meal a day. Her oldest, Yahiri, remembers how much she and her younger siblings just slept.
I would literally wake up right at 8 a.m. and join my class, and I don't even stay awake through the whole day. I have a study hall and I have my lunch, and I would just nap during those times. I wouldn't even be up.
Yahiri, a senior in high school, said the younger ones fell behind in classwork. They just couldn't get through remote learning and stay awake on empty stomachs. When her mom's coworker shared information about a food pantry, their lives changed.
Especially because, like, now the pantries provide, like, fresh vegetables, which is something that we couldn't really even afford to begin with.
She says she and her siblings now can stay awake during the daytime. They're catching up on classwork. Despite the darkness of this past year for some of these families, hope is on the horizon. Most of them will receive thousands of dollars in tax credits per child through the new federal pandemic relief plan. This will look like hundreds of dollars in cash advances from the IRS monthly for the last half of this year. And in Illinois, kids who've been missing free or reduced lunches at school due to remote learning are finally receiving monthly debit cards to buy food. For Kate Mayer, these developments are a game changer. Mayer runs the Greater Chicago Food Depository and has been working around the clock to keep Cook County food pantries well-stocked.
All of that together is fundamentally going to shift the ability for people to access food. It's going to have a profound impact.
Mayer says it also provides a critical opportunity.
We can then focus our resources on people who may not be able to access the safety net.
Like people who are struggling to eat, but whose incomes may be too high to qualify for public benefits, or whose immigration status is a barrier to receiving aid. For people like Mayer, there's now a renewed energy around tackling hunger in Illinois, one that dares to think about ending hunger for good. Odette Youssef, WBEZ News.
Latinos are far less likely to have gotten the COVID vaccine. A reluctance to get the shot, grounded in language, culture, and other factors, piles onto the healthcare inequities that many Latinos already face. And as David Condos reports for Harvest Public Media, that could leave many meatpacking communities at risk.
Enrique Rodriguez Friends hosts the top Spanish radio station in southwest Kansas, La Mexicana.
Saludos, saludos, saludos.
That makes him a well-known guy in these parts.
Hello, young lady. How you doing?
How are you guys?
Good.
So when the National Beef Meatpacking Plant wanted more people to line up at its vaccine clinic in Liberal, they called him.
No symptoms.
He came to live stream his vaccination to over 20,000 Facebook followers.
That's it? No sentí absolutamente.
After getting his shot, he went to tell his 65-year-old mother.
She was like, oh my gosh, know that you're going to have consequences.
His mom doesn't want to get vaccinated because she's afraid of fictitious side effects she's heard from one bogus source or another.
So how can you fight all this garbage? I don't have the answer.
Francis' story illustrates the complicated task facing the country. Now that the COVID-19 vaccine is becoming more available, people need to be sold on taking the shots. In Latino communities, vaccine hesitancy, cultural barriers, and accessibility issues could hinder the rollout from reaching the most vulnerable.
Not all at once.
About 2 hours after Friends live streams his vaccination, a group of people from the Liberal area file into a community center conference room.
Did you guys all hear that?
They're here to talk about the vaccine, or more to the point, their concerns about taking it.
The chip could be like microscopic.
I don't really trust it.
The government will know exactly.
I just want to wait to see if
COVID worldwide for a purpose.
The most common concern in this room comes from a lack of clear, consistent information. Here's Edgar Galindo.
And I still keep asking, you know, questions that are, it's going to work or just you have to have it every year. I'm still waiting for that.
Rodrigo Calderon worries about where the shot came from.
I'm just waiting for more information. So, I mean, I don't plan on taking it, but maybe later on I'll change my mind.
And at least in this room, he's not alone.
How many of you guys would take the vaccine now?
Out of the 16 people in this group, just 2 say they want the vaccine. Janet Vasquez works at Southwest Medical Center in Liberal and organized the focus group.
People are already very emotional. I mean, COVID has been very challenging for a lot of people. And so hearing rumors about the vaccine just terrifies and scares them more.
So Vasquez has made social media videos with Hispanic doctors, posters with vaccine facts in Spanish, anything that might help more people get their shots. If messages about the vaccine don't speak to Hispanic residents in ways they'll take to heart, pockets of unvaccinated people could incubate future outbreaks. To be clear, resistance to vaccination stretches beyond Latinos. A recent NPR poll found nearly 40% of Latinos don't want the vaccine, but the figures were similar or even higher for white evangelicals and Republican men. The challenge in Southwest Kansas is that boilerplate public health messages likely won't reach Latinos in any meaningful way. Ernesto de la Rosa is the chairperson of the state's Hispanic and Latino American Affairs Commission. He says it'll take more than just translating information from English to Spanish. It's about making messages culturally relevant. He calls it meeting people where they are.
And I don't necessarily mean by place. I mean by their thoughts, their culture, how they go on with their everyday life.
It could be as simple as featuring the voices of native Spanish speakers or playing Latin cumbia music under an ad. Anything that lets Latinos know this message is for them. Radio host Enrique Rodriguez Friends plans to keep delivering this message in as many different ways as he can.
It doesn't matter how much information you create. What really does matter is how much information is actually getting to the people that needs and understand it.
And after he gets his second dose, he's going to pay another visit to his mom.
I ain't giving up on this lady. She's my mom, dude.
I'm David Kondos.
The McLean County Health Department Administrator Jessica McKnight says many of her agency's services remain at reduced capacity. Her department has also had to scale back or delay various health promotion campaigns in the past year because COVID-19 has demanded so much time and energy. She spoke with Eric Stock.
So when COVID hit, you had just been on the job for a few weeks and COVID naturally overshadowed everything. As you had to shift resources to address the pandemic, what were some of the things that you had to put in the back burner?
Really, you know, big picture planning. So strategic planning, getting out in the community more, because I really, you know, no one was meeting in person. So that's kind of shifted a little bit, getting involved in any new programs. So the most significant dip, I think, we saw in our clinics, so direct client services, adult and children's dental. So when I mentioned, you know, there were some programs and services that weren't happening, you know, there was a time there for several months in late spring where dental providers across the state were not seeing patients. Many dental procedures produce aerosol, which is a high risk of COVID-19 spread to staff and patients. And again, the other direct client services, HIV, STD testing here at the health department, the personnel that we had, especially before the contact tracing personnel came on board, the same personnel that were doing the testing and treatment for HIV, STD, STIs were the same case investigators and contact tracers.
Have those direct client services gotten back to normal at this point?
Not quite normal. So for our WIC services, there's still several that are done on the phone. We're still doing curbside pickup, the dental services. Everything is kind of in a reduced capacity. Again, we're living in a world where we're doing everything we can to social distance. So sometimes that means reduced capacities in your appointments. Again, just limiting interactions so that we can prevent the spread of the virus.
Hospital administrators have addressed this lack of preventative maintenance, people getting fewer regular checkups and health screenings because of COVID, and that has created its own health consequences. What have the consequences been from a public health standpoint that you've seen from having to, you know, withhold a lot of this maintenance or delay it over the last year?
I think we'll see it more going forward, the long-term effects, you know, of COVID and how it has affected all of our environments, you know, from delayed services to the effects on mental health and, you know, children in school. So, you know, I think time will tell us. It may even shift a little bit how public health, what our priority health issues are. That's something that we look at. We look at data from the community health needs assessment. And I think that COVID-19 will definitely have an effect on what we see in our data. And it may shift a little bit in our priority health needs. I think they still would probably be very similar. You know, we're looking at access to care and, you know, mental health, but we may see some long-term things that we will want to focus on in public health.
Are there any examples of initiatives that you had planned to transition back into as COVID subsides, perhaps, over this year? And has that started yet?
So some of the things, you know, just off the top of my head thinking about are, you know, mental health first aid and some of our health promotion programs, you know, looking at vaping education in schools. So these are things that we put on hold for a while, especially because, again, meeting in person is just not safe at the moment. But just like with everything else with COVID, finding ways to adapt and how can we do these programs in the world that we're in right now. So doing, you know, mental health first aid virtually or doing it online, you know, self-guided programs or, you know, vaping education. How can we maybe create the materials and share those with schools that so they can do that without us, you know, if we're not able to go into the school. So those are just some of the examples of, again, just kind of adapting to the world that we're in right now and still offering the programs that we're looking at.
McLean County Health Department Administrator Jessica McKnight, she talked with Eric Stock. McKnight says her agency has had to shift priorities due to COVID-19, and that's a similar story in other counties in Illinois during the pandemic. You're listening to Statewide. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, many countries allow for supervised injection sites for drug users. Advocates point to safety, but others aren't so sure it's a good idea. We'll hear more. Facebook posts by two Springfield police officers last year impaired police operations and harmed community relations. That was the conclusion of internal affairs investigations by the city's police department. Activists working to improve the relationship between law enforcement and the people they serve had similar reactions. Mary Hansen takes a look at the fallout from the two online posts.
Let's go back to late last May. A lot was happening. In Springfield, protesters were marching against the governor's stay-at-home order and mask mandate meant to curb the spread of the coronavirus. That audio is from a State Journal Register video. Then the police killing of George Floyd, a black man in Minneapolis, sparked anti-racism and Black Lives Matter demonstrations nationwide, including in the capital city. This is around the time two Springfield police officers made Facebook posts that eventually got them suspended. In a widely covered incident, Officer Andrew Barnes criticized the city's two black city council members. Springfield Police Department internal documents show Barnes wasn't the only police officer in trouble over social media use at the time. In a previously unreported incident, Officer Todd Schwer responded on Facebook to an image of demonstrators blocking a truck on a highway. Quote, "This has got to stop. This is terrorism," he wrote. He went on to say that being a police officer prevented him from commenting, but then encouraged violence against the protesters. This is according to documents obtained by NPR Illinois through a public records request.
And we talk about building trust all the time. And those statements did not build trust, did not help build trust.
Robert Moore is a retired U.S. Marshal and chair of the NAACP Criminal Justice Committee. He says the situation with Barnes took the efforts towards better police-community relationships a step back. The police department suspended Barnes for 15 days and made him take anger management and community relations training. The department suspended Schwer for 4 days. The union that represents Springfield police officers declined to comment on behalf of Barnes and Schwer. A spokesman for the police department wouldn't answer questions about the incidents, saying they are personnel issues. Moore says the investigation into the post about protesters shows that the police department is enforcing its social media policy.
Without having meetings about it, or without even being brought to our attention, that they voluntarily took the action that was necessary, I think, and I applaud them for that.
The Springfield Police Department instituted a new social media policy 3 years ago. Officers can express themselves on social media as private citizens, the policy says, but those posts can't negatively impact the work of the department. The policy prohibits Springfield police from using obscene or sexually explicit language or expressing racial or any other kind of bias. Sunshine Clemens, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Springfield, agrees it's a good thing the department is enforcing the policy. She hopes it deters other officers from making similar statements on Facebook or Twitter.
This is long, deep-rooted history of antagonism and antagonistic behavior between police and, you know, many minority communities, not just, you know, Black people.
Clemens says the post could move community relation efforts backwards.
So there's a lot of work and healing that needs to happen. And posts like that create resistance and, you know, make people not want to work towards that.
So if police officers can get in trouble over what they say on social media, why do they post?
They believe the profession has come under attack wrongly, that the public dialogue generalizes from the specific to everybody in a way that is inappropriate, and they want to defend their profession and, you know, their coworkers.
That's Will Acheson, an attorney who represents police unions in the Pacific Northwest and heads an information service for public safety unions. He says police officers' behavior is scrutinized more closely during times of protests, particularly ones that question police. Acheson said this need to defend themselves, combined with a confusion about their First Amendment rights as public employees, are some reasons police officers might post to social media in ways that get them in trouble.
Public safety employees right now, they're going to be more susceptible to discipline than any other type of employee. They better know that. They better understand that.
After explaining that the Supreme Court has narrowed public employees' First Amendment rights to comment publicly on current events, Acheson says he encourages officers to
ask yourself before you make a post, do I really need to be saying this? Think about what the consequences of that post might be.
A Facebook post that did come under public scrutiny last spring was a comment by Officer Barnes that disparaged the Black City Council members. He made it in reaction to their criticism over how police were regularly trying to disperse parties on the city's east side. In May, police closed down streets for the majority white protesters demonstrating against Governor J.B. Pritzker's stay-at-home order. A few hundred demonstrators marched with a police escort from the Bank of Springfield Center, where members of the Illinois House were meeting, to the State House. Many noted the stark contrast of treatment when compared to law enforcement breaking up outdoor gatherings on streets and parks in Alderman Sean Gregory's ward.
The feeling in my community is, well, dang, that our police officers have come and block off the streets for people who ain't even from Springfield, Illinois, and make us go home.
Gregory told city council members he didn't condone the parties, but residents were asking for, quote, equal application of the law. The criticism was repeated by Alderwoman Kristen DeCenso and Alderwoman Doris Turner. At the time, Police Chief Kenny Winslow defended the police response, saying the protests were constitutionally protected.
This is different from people parking in the middle of the road, getting out partying. They're just two totally different things. I don't know how else to explain it.
Hours later, Barnes, a 15-year veteran of the department who patrolled the east side, posted to Facebook calling Gregory an expletive idiot. Barnes wrote that partiers threw things at officers. In the comments, Barnes suggested sending the partiers to Alderwoman Turner's ward. Turner represented parts of the east and north side before taking an appointment to the state senate earlier this year. Gregory and Turner say the vitriol over their criticism of law enforcement spilled into their personal lives. Gregory said he received threatening messages, and both he and Turner say they bought additional security cameras for their homes. Gregory says he wanted city leaders to understand that calling out the two African-American city council people at that time, the way Barnes did, could lead to, quote, serious outrage from the Black community. City officials acknowledged Barnes' post in late May and announced he was on desk duty while under internal review. Here's Police Chief Kenny Winslow at the city council meeting following that announcement.
On behalf of the men and women of the Springfield Police Department, I'll say here, I'm deeply sorry for what my officer did. He messed up and I will hold him accountable.
Winslow gave an impassioned defense of police that night in response to both the outrage over the Facebook post and weekend protests.
We're not perfect. Our community's not perfect. But we're damn good. And with that said, we have a damn good police department.
The Springfield Police Department wouldn't answer questions from NPR Illinois about whether Barnes had returned to patrol duty. Police officers or unions can sue over discipline over social media posts as a violation of officers' constitutional rights to free speech. But Andrew Geronimo, director of the First Amendment Clinic at Case Western Reserve University, says it's hard to win those cases.
The general test is that government employees have First Amendment rights to speak on what are called matters of public concern, as long as they're speaking as a private citizen and it doesn't affect the functioning of their office.
Geronimo says if an officer's account clearly identifies them as law enforcement, then the court may not see the post as coming from a private citizen. The Springfield Police Union challenged the discipline case against Barnes, which is pending. The union declined to answer questions about its stance. A spokesman for the police department wrote in a statement that community relations is a priority of the department and involves every officer. Police officers walk neighborhoods and talk to residents, and the department encourages officers to serve as student mentors, the spokesperson said. Moore with the NAACP of Illinois says there's still work to be done.
We need the community to have a better relationship with our officers that patrol our cities and our precincts and our roadways.
Moore says he'd like to see similar commitment from the police union to build better relationships. I'm Mary Hansen.
A proposal making its way through the Illinois General Assembly would take a page from countries like Australia, Canada, and some of Europe, allowing for legal injection sites for drug users. Supporters say it's a way to prevent overdoses by supervising illegal drug use, but the idea has many hurdles to overcome. Derek Cantu has that story.
Americans have responded to drug addiction in a number of different ways in recent decades. The war on drugs of the 1980s and 90s spawned mass incarceration of Black and brown populations. Some addicts, many of whom have some measure of wealth and privilege, are sent to rehab. In the face of the opioid crisis of the last decade, there has been a growing recognition of the inevitability of drug use. That attitude change has led to the proliferation of clean needle exchange centers in providing overdose medication like naloxone to drug users, their families, and law enforcement. In Illinois, one state legislator wants to provide a legal path for another approach, allowing people addicted to drugs to take illegal substances under the supervision of a medical professional. Democratic State Representative LaShawn Ford of Chicago says supervised injection facilities, which he calls safe consumption rooms, would reduce the likelihood of fatal overdoses.
We know that not meeting people where they're at to provide the support that they need in the struggle of a substance use disorder only harms the community with loose needles, only harms families with preventable drug overdoses.
Currently, such facilities are illegal in the United States. At least 7 states and a few cities in the U.S. have tried to pilot legal injection site programs, but have mostly failed in the face of pressure from the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration and U.S. Justice Department. In all of those cases, the idea that users would bring their own drugs is a huge legal sticking point. In Philadelphia, a nonprofit called Safe House has been locked in a legal battle with the feds over its proposed injection site. Federal prosecutors there claim Safe House's project would violate the so-called crack house statute within federal drug law, which makes it a felony to operate a space dedicated to the manufacturing, distribution, or use of illegal drugs. Robert Bell, special agent in charge of the DEA Chicago Field Division, couldn't speak specifically to the Safe House case, but says the whole concept of a legal injection site does more harm than good.
When users purchase heroin and fentanyl, those transactions stimulate the illegal drug market by putting money in the hands of profit-driven drug organizations and even violent gangs.
Bell says instead of normalizing intravenous drug use, the DEA recommends drug counseling by medical professionals and occasional doctor-prescribed medicated-assisted treatments. But Rhonda Goldfein, the executive director of Safe House, says her organization is not encouraging drug use. Rather, Safe House would be providing an alternative approach to addiction. Drug overdose rates in Philadelphia are one of the highest in the country.
Safe House is composed of people of faith and conscience. We believe that if you can save a life, you're required to save a life.
North of the border in Canada, North America's first legal injection site fought for years to get exempted from that country's federal drug laws in order to operate. That was nearly 20 years ago. And now, Dr. Mark Lesician, Deputy Chief Medical Officer at Insight in Vancouver, says his organization sparked a movement that's extended to 25 other facilities across Canada. Lesician says Canadian centers like Insight also provide a number of wraparound services for patients, including access to counseling, test strips to determine whether drugs contain fentanyl, and clean needle exchanges.
We have, you know, we typically around 100 injections there a day, and, you know, since its opening, there's never been a death due to an overdose.
Representative Ford's proposal also calls for funding of other resources and services at safe consumption sites, including condoms, naloxone, educational literature, and drug rehabilitation counseling.
We know that in neighborhoods where overdoses are very prevalent, that resources are very low to help people with substance use disorder. This will be one that speaks to them directly.
Ford's proposal cleared a House committee last month and is set for debate on the House floor later this spring. I'm Derek Cantu.
A Chicago student recently won the Illinois State Championship for a national poetry competition. Yvonne Booz tells us more.
Emily Dickinson at the Poetry Slam by Dan Vera. I will tell you why she rarely ventured from her house.
Catherine Herrera is a senior at Taft High School. The 17-year-old first took part in the Poetry Out Loud contest a few years ago. She says she originally entered the contest because she loves performance theater.
I realized when I was reading these poems that it kind of felt like a monologue that I would be able to do in theater. And it felt like I could bring a sort of character to these pieces.
Herrera explains that she's a musical theater enthusiast and has participated in many productions and contests. Her first professional theater competition was the Jackalope One-Act Living Newspaper Festival. Herrera adds that performing spoken word is a little different from the type of art that she is used to doing.
I feel like with poetry, there's this newfound sense of power that I also can feel, because your words, everyone is hanging on to your word by every single phrase and verse that you're saying in a poem, and every word is so important in poetry out loud.
Brian Wilson is a drama teacher at Taft. This is his first year serving as a Poetry Out Loud school coordinator, but he's helped with the event in the past. Wilson says the school is proud of Herrera and that she has many accolades besides this one.
Like the Chicago Youth Theater Festival. She didn't quite mention it, but she won the musical theater competition this year, was a finalist last year.
Wilson says this year's preparation for the event was different because it wasn't in person. He mentions that some students who would have normally taken part didn't feel comfortable with the in-home surveillance.
And with some of the mandates that we have as teachers, we can't really say students have the cameras on. We know that there's equity issues with that. We know that there's some students that just is not an option.
He says there's a shared heartbeat that is felt when things take place in person, and this is missing during the virtual events. Herrera would agree. She mentions that she is much more comfortable with performing on stage.
There's this different sensation you get when performing poetry in front of like a large audience like that, in front of a microphone and on a stage, where your words, you can hear them through the microphone and they just sound so much more powerful.
While Herrera may enjoy the live setting, Wilson says one of the biggest challenges that most students face is nervousness. Last year, Herrera didn't advance at the state level of the competition. And so she didn't get to perform the poem, The Collar by George Herbert, which she had practiced and had hoped to do. She says this time, given the chance, she wanted to make sure that she was able to bring the piece to life. She notes her favorite part.
There's this line where I think it goes, to suit and serve his need deserves his load. And I love that line so much because I feel like that is the climax of the poem.
She says the word deserve carries the most weight because most people can relate to it.
He that forbears to suit and serve his deed deserves his load.
Herrera says she didn't have an affection for poetry early on. She didn't really understand it at first, and she thinks a lot of people don't explore it because they don't quite get it. But she says being a part of this contest helped her understand the power of words. She suggests that if people recite the words of a poem or even record themselves saying it, they may develop a deeper affection for the art too. The Poetry Out Loud competition will conclude with the national championship on May 27th.
Back to life. Dead.
I'm Yvonne Booz.
Speaking languages, living and dead, their minds retentive. Their five senses intact, their footprints like a butterfly's.
Thanks for tuning in to Statewide, and remember our website is statewideshow.com. You can find out more about the stories you hear each week, and still to come, how did people respond to the news Lincoln had been assassinated? An author shed some light. Stay with us. I'm Sean Crawford, and you're listening to Statewide. Coming up, Lincoln's assassination, how the news spread, and reaction to it. The new Oakfield Place apartment complex is in Henry, a Marshall County river town about an hour due north of Peoria. So how did Champaign County's Housing Authority get involved in managing those apartments more than 100 miles away from their community?
That's a good question. We actually get asked that quite a bit. So Housing Authority of Champaign County, we are a moving to work agency, and so it allows us to think of innovative ways to create housing opportunities.
That's Tamika Couch, the interim deputy director of the Housing Authority of Champaign County. The 30 income-restricted units in Henry offer independent living for seniors in Marshall County, which lacks its own housing authority. Couch says they're looking to serve more rural communities like Henry, with two more projects upcoming in Ladd and Robinson. Well, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke to the AFL-CIO on October 7, 1965, at the Illinois State Armory in Springfield. A Chicago Democrat, State Senator Robert Peters, has introduced a resolution that would commemorate the occasion with a bronze plaque.
The AFL-CIO told me about this historical moment at the Armory where Dr. King spoke and said, would I be interested in doing a resolution on it, and I just jumped at the bit. I said, of course, Dr. King is a hero to myself and to millions of people, but he was a complicated figure. His story has been told to us in a sort of straightforward way, and it was actually complicated. He was fighting for justice, and it's important to remember during the 60s that he did not poll well. He was not a beloved figure he is like today because what he was fighting for, tough, kept on fighting. And he did it with a group of people. I mean, there's just a whole host of people who've been involved in the organizing effort that Dr. King was a part of. And so he was himself a divisive figure in many ways. So that's not the image we're generally taught when we're younger. He did it in a coalition that he organized with that was multiracial, multigenerational, and people of different genders, but, you know, folks from labor. And so to me, when I think about Dr. King and his story and his legacy, it was the idea of hitting the intersection on race, class, and gender. And so him speaking at the Armory to the AFL-CIO and speaking on behalf of the labor fight and how the labor fight is tied to the racial justice fight is something that I think needs to be commemorated, because I think as we move from what the last year has been in terms of a pandemic and economic crisis and a crisis in systemic racism, we need to sort of look at the legacy of Dr. King and say, we need to make sure that everyone has the safety and the dignity they deserve.
That's State Senator Robert Peters. He's introduced a resolution to commemorate a 1965 speech by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. in Springfield with a bronze plaque. We've all heard how the U.S. was sent into a period of shock and grief when word of Abraham Lincoln's murder spread. Newspapers reported it that way. But what about the average American, North or South, white or black? Martha Hodes set out to learn more from their letters and personal notations. The NYU professor wrote a book on the subject called Mourning Lincoln, and it brings their intimate thoughts to light in the months after Lincoln died. We spoke with her previously, and as we approach the anniversary of Lincoln's death, we revisit our conversation.
Well, lots of people have written about Lincoln's assassination, but most scholars and writers who've written about Lincoln have written about public responses. So they've used newspaper articles or sermons or public expressions of condolence, and all of those are important points. But nobody had thought to read through hundreds and hundreds of letters and diaries and other personal writings that were created in the immediate aftermath of the assassination, so literally in the hours, days, and weeks following Lincoln's assassination. So by reading through these sources, and I did read through hundreds and hundreds of such sources, of course there are many I didn't get to, but by reading through those sources, we get a different vision. We get a vision of a nation that is not united in mourning, which is something that many of the public sources claim. We get a vision of a nation quite divided right at the end of a civil war that terribly divided the nation. So that's what was so interesting to me. The personal responses illuminate a key moment of confusion and conflict that's been left out of the story.
Certainly, people in the South may have taken quite often a different view of Lincoln when he was alive and even in death. Is it your take that maybe people might have felt differently about his assassination had it not been for the Civil War, and especially had it not been so close to the end, the defeat of the Confederacy?
For Confederates, the trauma of the moment was less Lincoln's assassination than the fact that they had just lost this terrible four-year bloody war. And you can see that in personal writings of Confederates, because at times they will make a notation of the assassination but spend most of their time lamenting the defeat. Now, when Confederates thought about Lincoln and Lincoln's assassination, two things happened. First, Confederates did despise Lincoln, and that was because of the Civil War, and of course his election is what prompted secession. But the other point that's so interesting is at the same time the Confederates are celebrating Lincoln's assassination, because it's almost like a moment of reprieve for them from the horror of defeat, they're also worried because they have this sense that Lincoln would have been good to them had he lived, whether or not that's true. So while the freed people are calling Lincoln their best friend after his assassination, so are white Southerners calling Lincoln their best friend right after assassination. By the way, that wasn't something that developed later over the years and decades of the Lost Cause. It was something I found on the day Lincoln died in white Southern writings.
And there has always been that theory that Reconstruction might have gone differently had Lincoln lived. People were worried, you know, what happens to me? What happens to the South? What happens to the way of life that I've known? And especially with somebody unknown taking the White House.
Think at first, or I should really say white Northerners and white Southerners think at first that Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, the vice president, is going to be tougher on former slaveholders and the Confederates because Johnson is known to have hated the Southern aristocracy. African Americans, however, have a sense right from the start that this is not going to be the case. And African Americans know this, and I realize this through reading letters in black newspapers and Frederick Douglass and other kinds of black voices. Johnson's roots are as a poor white Southerner, and they make the point, African-American mourners make the point, that Johnson hates black people more than he hates the Southern aristocracy. And that's, of course, what turns out to be true in Reconstruction. Johnson essentially sides with the Confederates and dismisses African-Americans. And I have many petitions and letters that African-American mourners wrote to Johnson saying things like, think about what your noble predecessor would have done, you know, were he alive. And Johnson does not follow through on the policies of black, not just black freedom. I mean, freedom has been gained, but equality, citizenship, land, education. So we do not know, we cannot know what would have happened had Lincoln lived. But there is a sense, and Frederick Douglass makes this point, that he would have listened to black petitioners. He would have listened to African Americans, the freed people, black politicians, black leaders, in a way that Johnson did not. Johnson dismissed those people out of hand when the war was over and he took the presidency.
For African Americans, one of the greatest victories that they had known up to that point during Lincoln's presidency, emancipation, without Lincoln there, many of them felt as though that the rug would be pulled back out from under them, correct?
Absolutely. Of course, African Americans had been critical of Lincoln during the war. They thought that he was too slow to act upon emancipation. By the time the war was over, Lincoln had been influenced greatly by African Americans and by white abolitionists as well. And of course, there was the Emancipation Proclamation by then. There was the second inaugural address by then in which Lincoln made clear that slavery was the cause of the war and God would not let the war end until slavery was over. And then there was the last speech that Lincoln made. Of course, no one knew it would be his last speech when he stood on the White House balcony on April 11th, in which he hinted at his preference for suffrage for certain groups of black men. So once Lincoln was assassinated, African Americans, you're absolutely right, we're devastated. and proceeded to invoke Lincoln as a model of a radicalism that he may or may not have lived up to had he lived. But the fear among African Americans was very great, and white mourners conceded that the loss was greater for African Americans than for themselves. In their diaries and letters, they would make that point.
We're talking with Professor Martha Hodes. She's the author of Mourning Lincoln. You feel as though that the public may be a little misinformed when it comes to Reconstruction and how that was handled because of Lincoln's death?
Yes. So there is a misconception that because Lincoln was assassinated, the North was harsher on the vanquished Confederacy. What I found in reading through all of these sources was that people understood, Lincoln's mourners understood the assassination as a message from God indicating that God had to take Lincoln away because otherwise the Confederates would not be treated with the kind of harshness they needed to be treated with in order to make the nation move forward. So instead of avenging Lincoln's assassination, the Union wanted to avenge war, secession and war, and also slavery, because people were very clear, mourners were very clear, not only abolitionists, that Lincoln was assassinated because of slavery. That was what was to blame. Of course, Booth was to blame and Confederate leaders were to blame, but slavery was the cause of the assassination. And people made that comment even before they went to church on Easter Sunday, and ministers made that comment. So the treatment of the Confederates during Reconstruction was a result of everything that had led up to Reconstruction without the assassination making it any worse. That's not what people were avenging. And I think it's very important to understand that people took this, Lincoln's mourners took this as a message from God to move the nation, especially in the view of black and white radicals, giving African Americans the vote, education, land, citizenship, equality, freedom.
And we talked about the South, but what about the North? And what we've always heard, as you'd mentioned earlier, was that newspaper accounts were that the North was in a terrible mourning after the assassination. Is that what you found in these personal writings?
Well, yes, in many ways. I thought, I expected to find that the major responses would be shock and grief, and they were. So people were utterly astounded, stupefied. They couldn't believe it was real. They were overcome with gloom and grief. Men were weeping in the streets. All of that was true. What I also found in the North was that Lincoln's opponents, the so-called Copperheads, were celebrating the assassination in some of the same ways the Confederates were celebrating the assassination. So they were reveling, they were laughing and clapping and cheering in the streets. Of course, some people stayed out of sight for fear, and the ones who did demonstrate that kind of glee were threatened and sometimes visited with violence. They made jokes about Lincoln. Just to give one example, one man made the comment that he has as much of a brain now as he ever had, which was a reference to John Wilkes Booth shooting him in the head. Union soldiers and sailors who were Copperheads said terrible things about Lincoln and were visited by the wrath of their comrades. So not even the North was wholly unified. And what's so interesting is that Lincoln's mourners will say in one sentence, the whole world is mourning. And then in the next sentence in a diary or letter, we'll describe some of the people in their town who are not mourning Lincoln, but who are reacting with glee. So they know it's not true, but it's a kind of comforting trope that the whole world is mourning for Lincoln.
Many of us, if we didn't live through it, certainly have seen many times the assassination of John F. Kennedy on television and the film that has become so famous of that. We didn't have that film of Lincoln. Do you think those two incidents were treated differently because of the lack of the visual imagery, or could you tell that from what you were reading?
When Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, people got the news from television or radio, and then television was the key way of making this real, that this had really happened. If you didn't have a television at home in 1963, you stood out on the sidewalk in front of an appliance store watching television in the window, in a crowd of people. Today, if there was a catastrophe, people would turn to their cell phones and social media. When Lincoln was assassinated, people would get the news from a telegram or the newspaper, sometimes the morning it happened, if the telegraph lines were connected. And then it seemed so unbelievable that the first thing people did in 1865 was leave the house and verify that this had happened by looking into one another's faces. So over and over again in diaries and letters, I would find descriptions of people saying, I immediately got up from the breakfast table. I got dressed. I went outside. I looked into the stricken faces around me. I saw expressions of horror and grief. I saw tears rolling down people's cheeks. People knocked on doors. They rapped on windows. They told other people. The way to see that this had really happened was to verify human expressions. So sometimes I like to say not Facebook, but human faces in 1865. That was essential to understanding that this event had really come to pass.
Martha Hodes is the author of Mourning Lincoln, detailing her research into how people reacted to the president's assassination. Abraham Lincoln was killed 156 years ago this month. Well, that's all the time we have for Statewide. We'll be back next week with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this week's episode, you can find it and past shows at our website, statewideshow.com. Our podcast is available through the NPR One app. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Just look for Statewide Show. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.